3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
You bet.
This appeal is to correct a legal anomaly that happened at the district court level. The decisions in this case at the district court level are completely contrary to over 100 years of federal case law. The respondents here have called the Carmack Amendment a federal supreme law that provides uniformity to a shipper and moving company whenever a dispute arises. We agree with them 100% on that. We believe that the Carmack Amendment dictates exactly what should have taken place here at the district court level. It entitles the appellant to certain damages and imposes certain requirements on moving companies that they must comply with in order to have any type of limitation on liability. Despite testifying that they have over 150 years of combined experience in the moving industry, the respondents here fail at every turn to comply with the Carmack Amendment and its requirements. Appellant, on the other hand, has demonstrated that the Carmack Amendment entitles him to certain damages that I'll get to here in a moment, but more importantly, that a reversal is required on virtually every substantive order from the district court in dealing with this case. Getting to
your point is that you are entitled to damages for delay and consequential damages as a result of their failure to ship. And one of the things reading this case that struck me is there's a divergence in what you're saying about the underlying bill of lading, letter of acceptance, and whether, in fact, your client was trying to change the terms of it by insisting on a particular window, or if that was a reasonable condition to attach on the authorization of additional funding on his credit card, that was what was always contemplated because it was 3 to 5 weeks in the latter part of May. Could you comment on that? Because to me, that's an important piece of it, even though the briefs don't really get into it too much.
Sure, and I think the reasons that the briefs kind of skip past that was because that wasn't what the judge had said his decision was based on. But there certainly is a genuine issue of material fact as to what the dispute was. My client has testified, and we have a number of documents that were produced in exchange in this case that established, you know, that there was certain terms that the respondents agreed to meet, such as certain deadlines, such as a certain weight and price. And of course, they have contested that. And it was the subject of their motion for summary judgment for fraud, which Judge Denton initially denied that motion, only to later dismiss the fraud claim because he ruled that it was precluded under the Carmack Amendment. But when we're dealing with the federal claim, Judge Denton was very clear. In fact, the respondent's only argument in the reply was that the appellant was not entitled to any damages whatsoever because he could not establish that there was physical damage to the property.
Right, and that's what it caught my eye, because if you have a claim for delay damages, then it would seem to me under the case law that interpretation of the statute that Denton gave is unreasonable because it hasn't been adopted federally.
Exactly.
And I understand that point, but how do you have a claim for damages for delay if you did not tender the money that was required under the contract and tried to add additional terms?
The
question I have.
Sure, and we absolutely dispute that. My client did tender payment. He provided a down payment, provided the authorization for them to charge the additional monies to his account. There's actually a document that is part of the discovery in this case that establishes that he did, in fact, provide them authorization to charge his account for the agreed upon price and for the amount that they agreed upon and for the delivery time frame that they agreed upon in the contract and in their agreement that they made before the items were ever even picked up. They have contested that he, in fact, did not provide him the authorization to charge his card, which we absolutely dispute. They argued that point to Judge Denton in the earlier motions for summary judgment. Judge Denton was not persuaded by that. He denied their motion for summary judgment based on fraud, for our cause of action based on fraud, and made his determination only on the issue of actual physical damage to the property. And we have provided numerous documents establishing that, in fact, Mr. Rose did suffer damages as a result of the delay, inconvenience. They took hours and hours of deposition time on him going through those documents and what those damages were.
What do you say to your opponent's argument that you're raising this argument for the first time on appeal and that's inappropriate to introduce that way?
Sure. Absolutely. Reviewing the transcript of the hearing on that motion, no one could possibly contend that I myself did not say to Judge Denton that their case law and their interpretation of 14706 is absolutely dead wrong. There is case law out there that says that my client is entitled to damages for delay, inconvenience, and hostage. It's in the transcript, and I've attached that that language in the reply. Now, considering that the issue of actual physical damages was first raised in their reply brief, my first opportunity to address that to the court was at the oral argument. And I absolutely raised that. I said, they're wrong. There's lots of federal case law out there that says that they're wrong, that says that we're entitled to these damages. And Judge Denton turns to the respondent's attorney and says, you have the last word. And he says, no, that's not true.
Did you move to strike the reply orally or in writing or challenge its propriety?
Absolutely. We also raised the issue that was a first-time argument that was raised in the reply brief for the first time. And then I went on to address the issue of what damages my client was actually entitled to. And even though it's not admissible, it is not part of the appendix in this case, we also filed a motion for reconsideration on that issue as well. Getting to the other issues that are involved in this case, the issue of preemption and the motion to dismiss that the respondents have filed in this case that was granted. Judge Denton, in our opinion, simply accepted their interpretation of what Carmack preemption was. Preemption under Carmack has certain limits to it that a carrier or moving company has to meet in order to have that preemption. And the number one being that they actually have to be a carrier. And there is at least a genuine issue of material fact in this case. And we even allege in the complaint that they are a middle person or that we are unsure exactly who DDS was in this case. But the case law that we have provided in the briefing is clear that if they are not a carrier, and if in fact they are a broker, which is what their owner has testified to in deposition, they're not entitled to preemption. It's plain and simple.
Their argument is that you affirmatively alleged and maintained throughout that they were a carrier, and therefore you're doing sort of a sub rosa amendment.
Could
you comment on that?
Sure. I understand that that is their position, and I strongly dispute that, because in the complaint, in the seventh cause of action, we explicitly say that they are a middle person and that they have misled themselves or have misled my client as to who they really are, that they are using third-party agencies or agents to move these goods. That makes them not a carrier. That makes them a broker. Then under...
So you're saying those were alternative theories of your approach on them?
Yeah. We weren't sure who they were. And for the purposes of liability under Carmack, we now know that Movers Pac-Man is a carrier. But as far as DDS is concerned, as far as we know, they are only a broker.
Mr. Bach, can you talk about attorney's fees, whether they're proper for either side, and also the sub-issue, the offer of judgment, and sure. I think it was for $25,000, as I recall.
Sure.
And if it was faith and all.
Sure. Well, and I think that one of the primary issues that comes into play when you're dealing with attorney's fees and the offer of judgment in this case deals with the reasonableness of it. And we've outlined how there's this enormous requirement that a moving company has to provide arbitration. So when my client is in a position of evaluating whether or not an offer of judgment is reasonable, it has to be taken into context that we already know the federal law required for them to be entitled to attorney's fees that they had certain arbitration requirements that had to be met. Combine that with the fact that they had at that point conducted no discovery on the issue of the Carmack Amendment. We knew that our damages were far in excess of the offer of judgment amount. Our interpretation, which I believe is the correct interpretation of the federal Carmack law, said that not only was he entitled to his actual damages, but his consequential damages, potentially punitive damages, and the only person in this case who could possibly be entitled to attorney's fees under the Carmack Amendment is the appellant. And the reason being that the federal statute dictates that the only way that a moving company can be entitled to attorney's fees under the Carmack Amendment is if they agree to provide arbitration is conducted, and a individual or person who shipped the goods in bad faith goes and files the suit. So in our opinion, the offer of judgment could not have been reasonable for the simple fact that it's contrary to what the federal statute says.
It have been reasonable only as to their counterclaim, and if not, why not?
Well, no, because the Carmack Amendment controls that as well. The cases, in fact, that they cite to in their brief that is supposed to support their allegation that the Carmack Amendment doesn't apply to that is incorrect. The cases that they cite to deal with a relationship between a carrier and a broker, and the courts in a couple of instances have said that perhaps the Carmack Amendment may not apply in that case. There is zero case law out there that we have been able to find or that they have provided that say that a dispute or a claim that a carrier has against a shipper is not controlled by the Carmack Amendment. It is. But despite that fact, it wasn't the carrier who was a counterclaimant. It was the broker who my client did not even have a contract with, and I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Knight, on behalf of respondent.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. To begin, all of the appellant's allegations and claims against the respondents in this case arise from a single origin, which is namely the respondent's shipment of their property from Nevada to Hawaii. And as so, those claims arise and are governed by the Interstate Commerce Act. The Interstate Commerce Act was first enacted in 1887 and largely dealt with shipments on railroads. And in 1935, the Motor Carrier Act was added to it to extend that to bus lines as well as trucks and carriers of that sort, that they're common carriers. Now, being that this body of federal law controls interstate commerce, namely the Carmack Amendment, determines the rights for a shipper against a carrier. When those claims were tested and the pleadings were pierced, the appellant was unable to provide any evidence that he had in fact been damaged under the claims pushed forward or presented to the court under the Motor Carrier Act.
But his point is you didn't assert those until a reply, that you switched horses on your summary judgment and brought it up in reply, the limitation of damages argument, and that as a matter of law, that argument is incorrect. That's my understanding of his argument. Could you comment on that?
I would love to comment on that. And that's incorrect. From the time that they filed their complaint, they had sued under the Motor Carrier Act, specifically Section 14704. And it was a bit of a moving target because the facts and circumstances that arise under 14704 are a bit obtuse. When we tested the motion and said, well, the damage that's permitted by the statute under 14704 is for one, a violation of a transportation board order, which doesn't exist here, and number two, for charging excessive tariffs. Far from the circumstances and facts of this case, and so we moved for summary judgment accordingly. It was not until the appellant's reply that he stated...
You mean his opposition?
I'm sorry, in his opposition, in the penultimate paragraph, where...
He said he's got a 706 claim.
He throws in 14706 and identifies by extension of 14704 which subpart of the Motor Carrier Act he wishes to advance. The case that was cited in support of 14706 was KPX out of the Ninth Circuit, which has been overturned. And so there was no presentation of evidence. There was no discussion of how damages arise under 14704 or 14706. In fact, when the court specifically asked counsel during the hearing what material issues of fact exist with respect to this claim, counsel stated, quote, "All right, the issues here are really our legal issues." The court circled around at the end of the hearing one more time and said, "I'll give you one more chance to answer my question. What issues of material fact exist?"
But it is a legal issue of whether or not he's entitled to recover consequential damages for a failure to ship, even if there was no damage to the goods. I mean, that's his point.
That's not disputed, Your Honor. There are a whole slew of bases to have damages presented, but when he set forth 14706, the statute specifically states loss, injury, or damage to the property. Perhaps there are other provisions under the Motor Carrier Act and the Interstate Commerce Act which allow or permit loss.
Do you have a case that says no damages for anything other than damage to the property under 706?
I do not have that. I'm only
because the construction of the statutes that he sets out in his opening brief to me were persuasive that the statute saying damage to property is one thing, but consequential damages could be recovered as well. And I understood that to be referring to both 704 and 706, but you're saying I'm wrong on that understanding?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that they never presented evidence, the appellant never presented evidence that was before Judge Denton of what those damages would have been, whether it be 14704, 14706, or some part of the Motor Carrier
Act. But did your motion challenge them to do that, the motion as originally framed?
Your Honor, under the motion as originally framed, it specifically dealt with the fact that there was no evidence of an excessive tariff rate charged or a violation of administrative order, as it's pled under 14704. So the bait and switch occurred in the opposition in the penultimate paragraph when 14706 was first advanced. It was not advanced by the respondents during their reply.
So, Mr. Matter, if I
have one more question, if I might just. This ties to a statement you make in your brief, and it appears elsewhere. Designer informed Rhodes that the estimate was contingent upon final size and weight, that transit would take 3 to 5 weeks, and then am I quoting here, and a delivery date could not be guaranteed. Where in the record do I find the affirmative statement that the contract documents said a delivery date cannot be guaranteed? I looked for it and I couldn't find it.
Your Honor, it's attached to the... Let's see if I have it right here.
To the
February 8th letter agreement where it states that there is no delivery date that cannot be guaranteed.
I've got the February 8th letter and I'm...
Well, what it says, Your Honor, is that it's based upon a 3 to 5 week window. And when the depositions were taken, the parties were discussing that fact and specifically testified that he was informed that because you have force majeure, because you're dealing with port, because you're dealing with the condition of the high seas, you're dealing with shippers receiving the shipment on the receiving end, that there are a whole slew of factors that 3 to 5 weeks is a general target. But the condition precedent that has to occur first is there has to be payment for goods. The one thing that I wanted to point out to Your Honor...
Right, but you're saying that his letter created a change in material terms that justified the non-shipment.
I'm saying that...
So the payment was not the payment, right?
I'm sorry, say that again.
You're saying that his payment did not qualify as a tender of performance on his part because he attached conditions, which was a date range in May, that was a change in terms of the February 8th letter.
That is correct, and always it's when you look at the bill of lading, which is the letter of acceptance, states,
February 28th letter.
That's correct, states that shipment can't occur until payment takes place, and that never took place. And so even if my clients would have said, okay, you got May 18th, it never became a reality or a specific date that they're bound by until payment is made, and then we go 3 to 5 weeks from that time.
Okay, but the reason the payment was insufficient was entirely due to him wanting a date range?
That is correct.
Okay.
Now, to one thing to
and
add...
And there's no nothing that says the date cannot be guaranteed, reading that inferentially into the 3 to 5 weeks.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, speaking of the issue of the reply, I wanted to add, under the Cousy hearing, that ruling from this court, when the party who's moving for summary judgment does not bear the burden of persuasion at trial, they can overcome their burden of production by either producing contradictory evidence or an absence of evidence. When 14704 was tested, it was demonstrated that there was no evidence of an excessive charge for a tariff or a violation of administrative order. At that point, under Cousy, the burden shifts to a burden of production where the non-moving party has to transcend the pleadings by either affidavit or explicit evidence to demonstrate how they've been damaged.
Or legal argument. Here he says he had a 706 claim.
And we tested 706 in the reply that there was actual, that there's no evidence of actual damage or loss to the property. Discovery by that point, Your Honors, had closed, and he had never conducted an inspection of the property. And prior to that time, a motion had come before Judge Denton on the issue of conversion, where the court determined that there's no evidence to indicate that the condition of the property changed from the time it was placed in the van packs to the time that the motion was being heard and this discovery was closed. It was something that couldn't be amended. It was, and so the court was comfortable making that finding. And so the court used that as the basis that there's no injury or loss under 14706.
But where's the source of the requirement that there be injury to the property for a 706 claim?
The actual statute, 14706, states that it is a remedy for loss, damage, or injury to property.
But what about the U.S. Supreme Court cases that say that that isn't limited to physical injury to the property, it can encompass consequential damages?
I believe that it can encompass consequential damages, but what wasn't argued to Judge Denton at the time that that motion was heard was the issue of consequential damages. The entirety of the hearing, if you review the transcript, Your Honor, states that this is a legal issue and we've alleged all kinds of bases, but at the end of the day, there was no evidence presented of what that damage could be, which is, I believe, what led Judge Denton to enter into his statement where he said, it is true, as plaintiff says, that he has alleged damages, but now he's called upon to go beyond mere allegations to a demonstration of loss or damage. He never did that. That's the story of this case, is that there's a whole lot of arguing. There's a whole lot of
lawyering.
And it's an absolute moving target. And we're playing catch-up as we go along, because one second it's 14704, the next second it's 14706, the next second it's neither of those, it's consequential damages that's out there. And under any of those theories, all three of them, what the record is absolutely devoid of is a presentation to the court of what that evidence exists, whether by affidavit or whether by documents that are attached that says, here, look, here's how I've been damaged. Here's my contract. Here's what I had to do to replace these goods. Here's none of that exists. And Judge Denton appropriately ordered that there was a lack of evidence or proof to sustain a claim under the Motor Carrier Act.
Mr. Knight, maybe I could shift gears here, and I think Justice Pickering asked all my questions on that I was going to ask in that area. If I could switch the attorney's fees and the offer of judgment, is your client entitled to attorney's fees under the Carmack Amendment without, you know, based upon counsel's argument that this matter couldn't be resolved, you know, separately outside this litigation? And is $25,000 a reasonable offer, assuming you could make an offer of judgment to recover attorney's fees? Is that reasonable based upon the degree of potential damages in this case?
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing that's a critical distinction, I think, that has gone unmentioned so far is that the case law cited is that the Carmack Amendment is a remedy that's exclusive to a shipper as it pertains to claims against a carrier. It's not a two-way street, it's a one-way street. In fact, we cited cases out of the Seventh Circuit and out of Oregon, REI Transport, as well as In Transit versus Excel North American Road Transit, both of which state that claims by a carrier or a broker or a freight forwarder or whomever it is against a shipper fall outside of the Carmack Amendment and are not limited to the scope of what the Carmack Amendment has for shippers' claims. So knowing that fact, that federal law is not absolute as it pertains to claims including attorney fees by a carrier to a shipper, I want to draw the court's attention specifically to a Nevada case, That Nevada case is Pacific Intermountain Express Company versus Leonard Conrad, in which this court in 1972 had this issue where the Carmack Amendment controlled the interstate commerce claims, but the judge declined to award attorney fees, stating, believing that he did not have the authority to do so.
Mm-hmm.
This was tested by the Supreme Court, the Nevada Supreme Court, and came back and specifically said that no, it's okay for the district court judge to apply Nevada state law for an award of attorney fees. And that's because in addition to whatever remedies for attorney fees that exist under the Carmack Amendment, this court and the Nevada legislature has created provisions by which settlement is facilitated.
I have a question on that. If the federal law says you could not get attorney's fees for defending the federal claims if you hadn't had a counterclaim, are you with me?
I'm with you.
You would not be able to get attorney's fees on this record, correct?
I do not believe that the law says that, but that would undermine completely the point of NRS 18 with offers of judgment and Rule 68.
So you think Nevada law can enlarge the availability of attorney's fees under a federal statute?
It's not enlarging, it's complementing. They go hand in hand because they arise under two different circumstances.
But the federal statute says you cannot get attorney's fees unless you pursue arbitration first. I mean, it's fairly clear, correct?
We believe, Your Honor, that the arbitration provision was waived. I mean, there was hardly a request for arbitration there, and there's a course of conduct where the appellant went and filed suit before any of those things can take place. In fact, he said, look, if you don't agree with my position, then let's just let the court sort out the body, so to speak.
No motion to compel arbitration?
There was no motion to compel arbitration. And I also wanted to state...
But I have a... it seems to me, let's set to one side, let's assume it was incumbent on your client to request arbitration, and let's assume that your client did not, and let's assume, therefore, under the Carmack Amendment, your client, if there had not been a counterclaim, would not, as a matter of federal law, have been entitled to recover attorney's fees. Are you with me?
I'm with you.
And this action's brought in state court.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your position that a state court offer of judgment would entitle you to attorney's fees, even though federal law would not allow them, and the Carmack Act has pretty wide preemption?
Your Honor, I don't believe that they're in conflict. If there was a federal statute that says this is the express circumstance a party may have attorney fees, period, then that offer of judgment would, I believe, be irrelevant. However, what the Carmack Amendment states is, here are some circumstances that exist to have attorney fees. It does not say these are the sole and exclusive circumstances. And so when you then turn to Nevada legislatures, the law, as well as this court's rules, there are other mechanisms that arise that allow for facilitation of early resolution.
So there was no division in either the offer or the award for the costs of defending his Carmack claims versus the cost of pursuing your counterclaims? In other words, the fees weren't divided up?
No, because all of the cases went hand in hand. There was no reason to, because at that point we were chasing a moving target, and so we were entitled to the entirety of our attorney fees. We went through the analysis under Bergman and under Brunzel, and the judge agreed with us that the attorney fees were reasonable in light of the circumstance.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Mr. Bach, rebuttal.
And Mr. Bach, maybe you can talk about the other damages your client sustained other than property damage, you know, like that. And did your client, if it was no inspection, is there any evidence your client had any property damage done?
During the course of discovery, there was no evidence that was submitted that there was actual physical property damage done to the property that was in storage. However, my client also had claims, and this started before litigation even began, in the initial letters saying to the moving company, hey, look, I'm remodeling my home. I have moved everything out. I have to have furniture. I have a rental property that I'm doing construction on. I have business equipment that I need in order to conduct business. I am not just losing this property. I'm losing other revenue sources, and I'm going to have to replace a lot of these things, and I'm going to have damages as a result of that.
Well, did you ever quantify those for the court? Or?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that was the subject of their motion in limine to dispute those damages documents, which the court denied. In fact, a judge didn't allow them to take an additional deposition of my client to thoroughly go through all of those damages and what those damages were, so they had a complete understanding of that. The problem is that Judge Denton, his decision on the summary judgment on Carmack wasn't based on any of that. It was based on the sole interpretation that was provided of the statute, which was actual physical damage. You're right. We had not developed, because that's not where our damages were. We were very comfortable with the case law, and what the case law says that entitles to those damages, and that's what we are using here. Getting to the issue that that Justice Pickering raised on whether or not there was a dispute over him paying the charges on the move. Under the Carmack Amendment, they have to weigh the goods and provide a shipment weight before they can provide the final amount. When they came to load these goods, they put them in wooden boxes. The bill of lading required that they be shipped in a shipping container, and the weight had to be based on the weight inside a shipping container, not all of
But they claim that they did do the weight in the shipping container.
You know, we have absolutely zero evidence of that whatsoever, and if they did do that, they were required under federal law to let my client know and give him the option of being there, because he specifically requested being there, and they did not do that, and there's no dispute about that. So
let me ask you about the arbitration issue. Did you you initiated the lawsuit here. Did you request arbitration, or your client requested it at any time?
My client requested arbitration in a letter to the moving company before he ever filed suit, and that would be the binding arbitration that they're entitled to under the federal statute. The arbitration that the respondents are referring to was not binding arbitration, and by this point, my client had already had to replace a lot of these items. His damages were well above the $50,000 limit in the court annex program, and the bottom line is that if he would have consented to arbitration in district court, one, it's not binding. They certainly have.
Well, I'm not talking about the district court arbitration program. I'm talking about the what's referenced in the Carmack Amendment.
Sure, and he did request that, but probably the most important thing to remember about arbitration is that even though my client is the one in this case who offered it, federal law puts the duty on the moving company to offer the arbitration, not the shipper to ask the moving company.
And what was Judge Denton's position on your argument in that regard? Did he make any findings or anything?
He essentially disregarded that argument.
Okay. So it's not addressed by the district court then?
No, that issue was not addressed. It was essentially disregarded.
I have one more question.
Go ahead, Justice Pickering.
The fraud claims, initially Judge Denton denied summary judgment on it, but then later he granted it. He granted it exclusively on Carmack preemption. Is that correct?
Yeah, and keep in mind, he didn't grant summary judgment. He denied summary judgment.
He did a 12C.
Exactly. He granted a motion to dismiss based solely on Carmack preemption and not based on any of the evidence whatsoever in the case.
And you cited a couple, I think they're Seventh Circuit cases, where if I hold a gun to someone's head and say, you know, you're not getting your property back unless you give me $1 million and then I'll ship it, that would be independently actionable outside of the Carmack Amendment. Maybe I'm not doing those cases justice, but is that an aberrant line of cases? Is that a split of authority there?
Well, there is a split of authority in some cases when you're dealing with the carrier itself. However, when you're dealing with the broker, there is no split of authority. The broker is not entitled to any preemption whatsoever. However, dealing with just the carrier, who is Movers Pac-Man in this case, there are courts out there that have said that there are certain situations, the more extreme the fraud, the more you see these courts say, look, this is something that is completely above and beyond what Congress intended to control when they said that all of these shipping disputes are going to be governed by the Carmack Amendment, and particularly when there is the certain amount of fraud, like we have alleged in this case, that is taking place, and when there are certain emotional damages as well, that an individual, personal injury damages essentially, that an individual is claiming, that fall outside of the Carmack preemption for a carrier only, not for the broker, only for the carrier.
Right, but you may be stuck with the carrier because of the way the complaint was pleaded. I don't know.
Well, however, the complaint in the seventh cause of action, which is incorporated into the tenth cause of action, says that, that DDS is a middle person or that their identity is truly unknown and is pled as an alternative theory into the 10th cause of action, which is the Carmack claim.
Right. Thanks.
So, all right, thank you.
Well, Mr. Knight and Mr. Bach, thank you for your spirited argument in this matter, your briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and we're in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.